K-Mud Podcast presents.
Yeah. Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other Indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes and I'll be with you until 10 a.m. And I opened with Frederick Whiteface of the Lakota Nation, great CD, Matahota, which is his name in Lakota. And I opened with a grand entry song, and he's a jazz player, and he always wanted to, you know, mix his Lakota heritage with the jazz. And he actually recorded this CD I'm playing off of when he was 90 years old. Well, just a few minutes, I'll have Jim Page on the line, but I just wanted to quickly share a story with you. It's really an update on Oak Flat, because earlier this month, a decision by U.S. Court of Appeals cleared the way for the federal government to sell public land sacred to tribes in Arizona to a foreign mining company. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on March 13th denied requests for an injunction to block the transfer of Oak Flat on Apache land, a 2,522-acre site in Arizona's Tonto National Forest that holds ceremonial importance to the Apache people. And they sold it to Resolution Copper, a subsidy of multinational mining companies Rio Tinto and BHP. The transfer was finalized on March 16th. The lands are also home to endangered and threatened species such as ocelots and Arizona hedgehog cacti. Hours after the March 13th ruling, seven Apache women filed an emergency appeal in the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the transfer, noting that the sale and destruction of the site violates the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and their plea was denied by Justice Elena Kagan on March 19th. The San Carlos Apache filed a motion last week on March 26th asking for an en blanc appeal from the Ninth Circuit, which would form a panel of 11 judges to review the decision. The ruling and subsequent appeals are the latest in the decades-long legal battle over the land. Oak Flat was designated public land in 1955 by President Eisenhower, protecting it from resource extraction like mining and drilling. The land transfer to Resolution Mining was slipped into the 2014 National Defense Bill. And according to Resolution Copper, the area could yield 40 billion pounds of copper over the next 4 years. The company plans to use a technique called panel caving or block caving, removing large swaths of underground rock to form a crater nearly 2 miles wide and 150 feet deep. Copper is in increasingly high demand, and it is considered a critical component to energy technology like electric vehicles and cooling cables for AI data centers. Advocates saying mining will permanently destroy the site that has been a ceremonial ground to the Western Apache since time immemorial, as well as a habitat of endangered and threatened species, including ocelots and the Arizona hedgehog cacti. A public opinion poll conducted by the Center for Biodiversity, released in February, showed that nearly 70% of Arizona voters oppose the mine. Arizona Congressman Adelita Grijalva, who introduced a bill in 2025 that would have repealed the 2014 National Defense Authorization Act rider, released a statement on March 15 condemning the ruling. She says, quote, "I'm deeply disappointed by this decision, which will allow drilling to immediately begin at Oak Flat, a sacred and irreplaceable place for the Apache people. Oak Flat is not just a piece of land, it is a place of prayer, ceremony, and identity for the Apache people. This site should never have been traded away to foreign mining giants in a backroom deal that ignored tribal sovereignty, shut the public out of the process, and will destroy the environmental and critical water resources." It's, you know, the Apache people are not going to give up. They are just not going to give up. I want to play a song by Jim Page. It's about Anna Mae Aquash, and she was a warrior of the Wounded Knee incidents that happened in the 1970s. Jim Page wrote songs about Leonard Peltier. He's written many songs about Native people, besides everything else he's done. So let's hear Jim, and hopefully we'll get him online.
Thank you. the blow. From away up east where the weather gets cold, and the colder, colder winds they blow. And she said, I hear there's been trouble down here, blow, Dakota, blow. They said, trouble, we've been getting trouble every year, and the colder, colder winds they blow. And a May made a vow by the fire that night, blow, Dakota, blow, that she would give her life to the people's fight, and the colder, colder winds they blow. And then the voice in the whispering wind did say, blow, Dakota, blow. Somebody's gonna get hurt someday, and the cold, cold winds they blow. Trouble in the Pine Ridge settlement grew with the cold, cold winds that blow. And in 1873, blow, cold blow. The trouble exploded a wounded knee with the cold, cold winds that blow. And in 1874, blow, cold blow. There was a backlash beating at everybody's door, and the cold, Dakota winds they blow. And then the warning passed from tongue to tongue, blow, Dakota, blow, that there was trouble a-coming with the federal gun, and the cold, Dakota winds they blow.
Was Jim Page giving us a blow, Dakota, blow. And online I have Jim Page with me. And, you know, when I was trying to decide how, you know, how am I going to introduce him? What are some words to introduce Jim Page? And all I can think of is historian, because if you don't like listening to, you know, didn't like sitting in a history class, or you don't like people talking to you about history, well, then you just have to listen to Jim Page, because you'll get one of the best history lessons, because his music tells it like it is in so many ways. He's also been called the bastard son of Woody Guthrie, and he probably has has over I think at least a couple of dozen albums out. Good morning, Jim, and welcome to KMUD Radio on Heart of the Earth.
Good morning, Agnes. It's really good to talk to you again after all this time.
I know. It has been a while, but I'm really excited that you're going to be coming down to Garberville on Saturday and we get to all hear you again. When I talk about, what I want to ask, because I know you live up in the Northwest. Is that where you grew up or where are your roots from?
Well, I grew up in California. I was born in Palo Alto and I raised up in Cupertino, which in those days anyway was an addendum to San Jose. You know, and now it's like the epicenter of Apple computers or something. I don't know what it is, but it's way out of my reach. But you know, I grew up when there weren't any sidewalks and there were orchards, we had orchard trees in the front and the back of the house because the house was built on the side of an orchard. You know what I mean? It was slowly, suburbia was slowly encroaching upon all of the nature everywhere. It wasn't all that fast. It didn't seem fast to me, but still, you know, we played games in amongst orchards that had survey stakes in them because the trees are going to be cut down. And we play, that's just how I grew up. And then I got out of California when things were getting kind of gnarly in the music scene, and I hitchhiked across country to New York City, New Year's Day, 1970, you know, as cold as it possibly could get. I'd never been cold. You know, I spent a year out in New York in the Village and stuff like that, and then I fell in with some people that were from Seattle, and they were going home, and I'd never been there before, and it sounded adventurous and interesting to me, so I went out there, and I fell in love with the rain. And I fell in love with the fact that it was a city, but it was small, and it was slow. Okay, the economic depression had hit. Boeing had laid off like 30,000 people or something. I don't know what the number is. I'm making it up, but a lot of people. There was a sign on the road on the main highway saying, "The last person to Seattle, please turn the lights out." You know, but people had time for each other. They had time for me. They had to. I just started playing everywhere, and it was there that I fell in with the. You know, began to get a political education through the songs that I was doing. I was playing on the street and I was playing on the campuses. And, you know, you had to sing about people if you wanted them to stop and listen. So I sang about them. They would stop and listen. They would talk to me afterwards and say, "Yeah, you got this part right, but that part's wrong." You know, and I'd get this and I would get an education. And years later, here I am. And, yeah. So I just stayed in Seattle because I've got so many roots there that I built. Yeah. Over time.
I know. I've been here in Garberville, I think, 46, 47 years now. I know, and you actually have a whole album about Seattle that I know way back when. So was music, so that was part of your family? You just taught yourself the guitar?
Well, I had a teacher to learn how to finger pick, but then the rest of it I taught myself by going to, you know, you learn, let me try to wake all the way up. You learn the rudiments of the chords and holding the pick and all that kind of stuff. And this guy taught me finger picking, how to do that. And then you can go to a club and you can sit down, you can watch people's hands, and you can steal their songs. You can steal their licks. You can go home and practice what you just saw. And that's how I built an entire repertoire. I always made the songs my own. You know, to me, there was no sense in learning a song from somebody and doing it exactly like they did. You know, you learn it and then you make it your own and you make something cool and interesting for yourself. You know, and it was the 60s, so everybody had politics to one degree or another in their repertoire. I mean, almost everybody. People that didn't were kind of considered to be odd, you know. And I just kind of kept that with me. I write a song about whatever strikes my imagination.
Well, Jim, you're one of the last real true troubadours. You know, you just don't seem to have too many of them around anymore. They can just, you know, be in a situation, look up, and then just start singing about it and just, you know, come up creatively.
Yeah. No, I found out I could do that by accident years ago, a couple of times, a couple of accidents. Like, oh, my God, what did I just do? You know, and then you... For me, it's like I can't do it if somebody tells me to. I have to do it just kind of whimsically. So it just kind of like it cracks. There's a crack in reality in there. There's this thing happens, you know. But anyway.
You know, well, when I talk about, you know, history and your songs, I mean, I think, of, you know, well, your song Palestine, I you wrote it maybe 20 years ago, but it's just as pertinent today as it was then. You know, your Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Russian Roulette, of course, Heroes and Survivors, another Native American song. And, you know, and the first time I saw this, I said, oh, Amazon. And I thought you were going to be singing all about the Amazon forest. And no,
well, I am in a weird way.
In
right?
a weird way.
I mean, like, I'm saying to these people, you don't have the right. You do not have the right to call your international corporation after a place where these people live.
Yeah.
So I am singing about it. You know, it's like because it was boggling my mind that you know, one of the things that they do, the first thing they do is they encroach on your territory. The second thing is that they steal it, and then the third thing that they do. Is they name their cities and roads and stuff after what they took. It's a weird kind of, it's like an eternal thievery. You know, for as long as that city exists or that town or that corporation exists in the way that it does, they are stealing from you. You know, it's not just like temporary. It's not just a fleeting thing. It goes on and on and on. It's just, it's creepy. It's like driving around in a Winnebago.
No,
And you want to ask them, it's like, so how much of the money that you spent for this thing goes into the community? And people will look at you like, what's your problem? You know, it's just, it's weird. But anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I was thinking of, there was this movie that someone had made. It was, you know, a white guy, and he had been at Wounded Knee, and he had taken film, and he made this documentary. And but he would start talking when he first got up there, and he goes, well, you know, I was in my Winnebago traveling, and I just about lost it. I'm going, here he did this whole documentary about Wounded Knee, and he's talking about driving around in his Winnebago. So then when I had the questions and answers at the end, you know, I had my hand raised, and for some reason they wouldn't pick me. And I finally, you know, afterwards I said, excuse me, but, I mean, you understand that Winnebago are, you know, they're a tribe in Nebraska or Wisconsin, wherever, you know. It's not, you know, moving vehicle. I said, and I think you need to, you know, get this correct, you know, because a Native nation is not, you know, they have stolen. And I was just going off on him. And there was this young Native girl from, I think she was going to the college. College there, you know, and she had her paper pencil, and she was all, and she looked at me, she looked at him, and she kept looking at me, and you could tell that she had, you know, all the light bulbs going off in her head, you know, that I would have, you know, that I could just stand up to this guy, and, you know, even though he did this movie all about Wounded Knee, that I could call him out on that, and it really bothers me.
Well, maybe, no, I mean, you know, in all fairness, maybe he just didn't realize it. It's such a part of what we do on a daily basis. You know, I mean, we live in a country of thieves. You know, look at the history of the country. It's like it's one of the biggest thievery jobs around. You know, and we live in it, and a lot of people, myself included. I mean, I'm a white guy from, you know, California, for God's sake. And, you know, slowly but surely, you have to learn things. You see clues. You see patterns. You start to think. You start to ask questions. I was severely, ADHD. You know, all of a sudden, there was like a light switch went on. All of a sudden, I couldn't read anymore. And we're talking when I was in junior high school or grade school, I think junior high. All of a sudden, I couldn't read. I couldn't put sentences together. Nothing worked. You know, all my grades went off. It's like all of a sudden. And the only thing that I could focus on when I finally accidentally found it was the guitar. Okay, that I could speak with. I had a bad stutter, but when I had the guitar in my hands, I didn't stutter, and I could focus on the guitar, and it was what I used for the rest of my living experience to be coherent with the world. And so you use it to tell stories. And because you go through these turmoils in school of being taken out of class to go to see a counselor who's going to help you talk, but they don't ask what's going on in your family. You know, I had a friend. I'm sorry, I'm going really fast.
That's okay.
I had coffee in the morning. I haven't eaten. I had a best friend who was killed in Vietnam. Okay, while I was in school, he was a Mexican kid. Well, he's Mexican American. He's a Mexican kid. Bobby Cortez, his name was, and he was killed in Vietnam. He dropped out because he just didn't see any reason to keep going on with school. There was nothing for him in there. So he dropped out and he joined the Army and he went over there. And I remember I was sitting in math class and they made an announcement that Bobby had been killed. Now, I might be making that up because it doesn't seem like something they would do, but that's what I remember because that was the effect it had on me. And I sunk down in my chair like somebody put a boulder on my shoulders, right? Sunk down in my chair. And it just came into my mind, the whole school should shut down right now. Shut down. Everybody get out of class. We're going to have an assembly, and we're going to talk about this. You know? But they didn't do anything like that. School went on as usual, like this was supposed to be normal. So I had a trauma that I had to walk around with as though it were normal. And everybody else that had something like that happen in a country like this has to walk around with it as though it's normal. And you'd have to say it is normal. In an abusive household, it's normal for the parents to abuse the kids. In an abusive country, it's normal for the country to abuse you and people outside. So, but you grow up with this. And it was the 60s, and that stuff finds its way into your music, and you're doing these songs, you know, and anyway.
Yeah, well, I think...
Long answer.
The war in Vietnam, I think, woke up a lot of people, really woke them up, a whole generation that just said no. Just said no. And,
right.
You know, I know for me, I know how many... demonstrations I went to, and I mean, for me, what the real eye opener was, it was, you know, grad night, and this is, you know, Southern California, and all the senior classes went to Disneyland. They opened it up. You got there at 9 o'clock at night, and you stayed, you know, it was there till like four, and it was open up all night long. And, but that afternoon, that evening, President Johnson was going to be in LA. It was, Century, it's Century Plaza, Century City. I just remember this Avenue of the Stars, you know. And my girlfriend and I, I was going with my girlfriend to grad night, and we had gone to the demonstration, but we knew we had to leave because we had to catch the bus to get to, you know, to Hollywood High School so we could catch the bus to go to Disneyland. And so we, you know, we started walking up the avenue, and we looked up, and you could just see hundreds and hundreds of policemen with these big shields just marching down the road. And I was like, what the? And we hid in the bushes. We actually hid in the bushes and watched as they all marched by us. And then when they got past us, we looked down, and that's when they just started beating them all up. And it was just like, I mean, I don't know how, I don't even remember anything of Disneyland that night because stayed with me for so long to watch that happen. And, and you know, at that moment, I told myself, you know, this, now I know what it is to be a black person in the South or a Native American somewhere because this is what they do.
This is what they do. Yeah. And it's almost like they can't help themselves. You know, it's like, you get back in line, you shut up. You know, you sit back down. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know. Man, I was going to say something. I was going to ask you something, say something. Well, I wanted to say that it's an honor and a privilege to be going back to Garberville after this time, playing in Garberville. I don't know if I've been to the... I know what I was going to ask you, but I'll say this part first. I don't know if I've played in the Redwood Theater before. I don't think so, but I could be completely wrong.
I don't think so.
Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to it, you know. So what I wanted to say was, I wanted to ask you if you've heard a couple of songs of mine. First of all, you mentioned the Palestine. Did you hear the one that has the one that I released as a single about 2 years ago, maybe? Because I rewrote it. I took it apart and put it back together. During the pandemic, I did a lot of that stuff because something about the way I'd written it bothered me. Okay, and I needed to fix it. There was something that I left out, and there's something that I kind of pompously threw in there as if I know it. I know something, you know, about you people, you know, which is creepy. So I had to take something out and put something in, and then I also rekeyed it, and I worked out a cool guitar part, and then I recorded it in the studio with a saxophone player, a friend of mine named Jessica Lurie, and she brought her soprano sax and played these, like, Eastern Hebrew Arab scales in it. It's beautiful. I'm sorry, I just said that word. It's beautiful. It's really cool. And you can hear it on my Bandcamp page, and you can hear it on my SoundCloud page. And I can just fly it to you, but if you want to have it. Oh, and also a song called Angeline from last record I made, album number 25, I think.
I know you'd had at least a couple of dozen albums out. So which one? Really something because I have this really old. Okay, let's see. Let me do it this way. Our computers they have the most updated Spotify here, and at home right. I just have the very old a copy of it, and so they don't list them like they do in the right. old version. So, but I was going to close with Palestine. I don't know if it was the latest version. I can't find it. I have it on my CD at home. But I saw the updated version. It was on this morning, but I'm trying to find it. It is. I found it. Yeah, it's here. It's here. I was gonna close.
Okay,
with that.
Good. Because it's got the saxophone in it, man. I love it. It's so great. It's so beautiful. She's a great player. She's just such a good player.
Yeah, and I have you remixed Heroes and Heroes and Survivors also, so
right.
I really want to play
right.
that one too. I'm just so excited you're going to be here. I want to tell everybody it's going to be at the Redwood Playhouse on Saturday at 7 p.m. And it is a benefit for 4KMUD Radio. I really want to thank Andy for getting this together for mm-hmm. us and having you back here in Garberville. I know for me, like I said, music like this is, it's, you can listen to it. You can really, hear the message. And, people can talk about the oil spill in Valdez, but the way you right. tell the story is, yes, the captain did have a few drinks. Yeah, the captain did do, terrible things happen, and then positive comes out of that. And I know out of that situation that all oil liners have to be double hulled now.
Right.
I don't know right. if they can still bomb through them like they are right now, and keeping the oil. I don't know what the gas is like in Seattle, but right now in Garberville, Redway. I just looked up this morning at $6.45 a gallon for regular.
$6.45, almost $7 a gallon.
Yeah.
Wee.
Yeah, right. Hello. right here in Southern Humboldt.
Well,
yeah, so you have to, I start going down the hill, boy, my foot goes off, and I just, I coast my car whenever I can.
Oh, yeah. Have you got a stick shift? Because the gears can hold you back if you do that.
No stick.
Oh, okay.
I have a little automatic, but it's a great little car, and it gives me 36 miles to the gallon. So,
that's nice.
Yeah. And, I still am very careful, and luckily, I live closer into town now, so I'm only a couple miles away, opposed to, this long half hour drive that was, I moved closer into town. Even when you get older, but I'm glad I did like 13 years ago, as opposed to some people that are just trying to do it now. I'm going to be 77 in a couple of weeks. So,
I'll be 77 in August. Yeah, we're right up there.
But you just just keep on moving. I mean, I have to slow down a little bit. Like on Saturday, I have a rehearsal for Random People Theater that I'm involved in, and boy, I wish I had the energy to go up to Cal Poly because it's they're having the California big time there, all the native people, and then you're going to be in Garberville that night. And I said, okay, I'm at that age now where I just can't do all that in one day, so I'm going to give up the big time. But the local Wailaki people are going to have one in September down here. So,
good.
Go ahead.
Let me ask you before we say goodbye, because it sounds like you want. Are you at all positive about what's happening right now?
About what?
About what's happening right now in our the country, the politics, the Trump thing,
The positive thing is that it's waking people up to realize what is going on.
Right.
That's the positive.
Right.
I try to keep positive in my own. I think it's an individual thing. Like for me, I mean, I go to sleep every night. I make sure I have a smile on my face, no matter what has happened. I have a smile on my face. But it's. When you have a narcissist, And, you know, a person like that, they want all the attention, you know, as 47 does. And he doesn't care if it's positive or negative. I mean, narcissistic people don't.
Doesn't.
You know, they just
doesn't.
Want the attention, good or bad. They want the attention. And so they do the most outrageous things, and they can't get past 5 feet around themselves. And so there's so many people being hurt. And but I think the positive, I see more people reaching out to each other and helping each other more.
Right. I see, like you say, more people waking up to, you know, the reality, even though it's a little bit at a time. And I have, you know, radical friends who get kind of superior. It's like, those people aren't waking up correctly. They're not waking up to my standards. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, people wake up the way that they can. But the other thing is people are actually beginning to understand that the country needs to be fundamentally changed, not just Band-Aids, fundamentally changed. That character should never have been allowed to get on the ballot, let alone get elected. And the fact that he did both of those things shows you that the whole way that the whole format is wrong. Okay? It's wrong. There's loophole. I mean, It's porous. It's got all these back doors for criminals to come in and do things. You know what I'm saying?
And you just see that white supremacist thing come. You know, I mean, Cesar Chavez, within 24 hours of they're finding out he was a sexual predator. Oh my gosh! You know, they changed the name of his street. They canceled everything. You know, but yet you know these sexual predators that are in Washington and everywhere else, nothing.
They're still there. Nothing. I know the president is still the president. It's like, yeah, I know. It's crazy. I know. So you have to mull these things over, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't want to take up all your time. I really appreciate you having me on. I'll be here for the rest of the hour if you want me to, but I don't think that's fair.
And the reason I wanted to have you, because like I very rarely have a non-native person as a guest, but I just feel like your message and who you are and the history lessons that you teach are so important. I just felt, you know, and especially, you know, that you're coming here. I just thought, no, I have to have a talk with Jim and let people know. So again, it's Saturday night, 7 o'clock at the Redwood Playhouse in Garberville.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you, Agnes. That's very, very generous of you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Very generous and welcoming. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll see you Saturday night.
Okay, good. Okay, thanks. Okay, bye.
Bye. And again, I was talking with Jim Page, one of the last troubadours, and what I want to do now is play his song, Heroes and Survivors.
I'll tell you a story, all good friends of mine, of the heroes and survivors of a terrible time. Two great peoples separated by the sea, joined in understanding of a great calamity. Oh, great calamity. 1831, it was the darkest of their years. Andrew Jackson drove the chalk on the Trail of Tears, with a saber and the rifle on a 1,000-mile drive to the land of Oklahoma. Only half would survive. Only half would survive. They called it reservation. It was a cage without a wire. What 100 years later the Germans would admire, surrounded by a state that held the lock and key to the vision of their future and their free humanity. Oh, their free humanity. In the Emerald Irish land, famine stalked the countryside with doom on every hand. Starvation, desperation, driven to extremes, they died eating grass, their mouths stained with green. Oh, their mouths stained with green. And it was the British Empire that held the lock and key to their island reservation and their free humanity. Across the hungry countryside, they walked a trail of tears. Through death and emigration, half the people disappeared.
half the people disappear. Travels fast when it goes from hand to hand all across the mighty ocean to the Oklahoma land. And when the Choctaw heard the story of the Irish and their plight, they knew they were related, though their skins were red and white. Though their skins were red and white. And though their hands were nearly empty and their lands were nearly bare, they collected all the money that they thought that they could spare, and they sent it off to Ireland to their unknown new friends. $700, it was a fortune to them then. It was a fortune to them then. Now you may wonder at my story, you may marvel at its worth, but I tell you there's goodness in the people of the earth. And I tell you there is beauty in the darkest of the days, and a light that comes shining, blow the darkness all away. And blow the darkness all away.
And again, that was Jim Page, Heroes and Survivors. And I want to quickly share this with you. I was actually going to try to play the Bioneers. They've been having their conference the past week, and Gary Farmer, who's a Native American actor and artist, singer, etc. He spoke, and Julia Frusella, she watched it and she gave her interpretation. So I think I'd rather just share what she had to say. She goes, if you don't know, this is Gary Farmer. Gary Farmer is one of those people whose voice already carries history before he even begins speaking. He is a Cayuga actor, musician, and longtime builder of Indigenous media, born on Six Nations land along the Grand River in Oswekin, Ontario. Many people know him from Powwow Highway, Dead Man, Smokes Signals, Reservation Dogs, or Resident Alien. But he's not only a familiar face on screen and stage, he's also spent decades helping build space for Indigenous voices through media and music. Quote, American society has never been able to overcome the paternal view that leads the nation. I often wonder in my senior years what kind of world we could have lived in if the nation builders of the American Empire would have accepted Indigenous people as equals. We shared our foods, medicine, and mythologies to survive in the northeastern, often harsh climate. Our efforts to respect the balance and power of our natural world instead of manipulating our mineral resources for profit and maintaining a lifestyle that is obviously unsustainable after just 250 years of the American Empire. Our Handasi culture and ceremonial life is based on orations, spoken words, song, and dance. Our inherent knowledge of our worldview sustains us still today. We have survived the assimilation policies carried out against us. We've succeeded as nations of Indigenous people despite the ignorance of our place in the American and Canadian history. And she says, I haven't stopped thinking about Gary's words, maybe because they don't just ask us to revisit history, they ask us to grieve possibility. And what kind of world could we have lived in if the builders of the empire had accepted Indigenous peoples as equals? I've wondered that too, a lot. I've wondered what Turtle Island might look like now if the men who call themselves founders had understood that they were not standing at the beginning of civilization. They were arriving in the presence of nations, nations with governments, nations with diplomatic systems, nations with agricultural knowledge, medicines, laws, kinship structures, spiritual teachings, and political philosophies rooted in relationship rather than domination and greed. And what if they had looked at indigenous people and seen not a people to try to destroy, but a people to learn from? What was refused was not only indigenous people. What was refused was an entire world view, a way of living that knows the natural world is not beneath us, waiting to be subdued, but around us, within us, holding us whether we deserve it or not. Gary Farmer names this with such clarity. We shared foods, medicines, and mythologies. We shared what was needed to survive. That part of the story is not a myth. It's a fact, though it's often told in a way that still protects settler innocence. The empire did not rise because Europeans arrived uniquely prepared for this land. They survived in no small part because indigenous peoples helped them survive. We offered knowledge shaped by long intimacy with this world. We knew the seasons. We knew the medicines. We knew what sustains life in hard climates. We shared, and what came back was betrayal and attempted genocide. The builders of the American Empire took what was useful, then spent generations describing indigenous peoples as savages while building a nation on top of what we taught. And now, just 250 years into this American experiment, we see the results of that ignorance. If you look around, you see it. A burning planet, poisoned waters, communities starved of connection, a political culture so infantile and swollen with its own self-importance that it mistakes domination for strength. The American Empire keeps rediscovering, century after century, that men who crave power are often the very men who should never be trusted with it. This is what happens when a society confuses appetite with progress. Gary Farmer's words land so hard because they expose that lie. They remind us that indigenous worldviews were never primitive leftovers from some pre-modern age. They were and are sophisticated systems of knowledge about how to live well, how to live responsibly, and how not to destroy the source of life in the process. Imagine if those values had been treated as foundational. Imagine if the dominant culture had learned restraint instead of worshiping profit at any cost. Imagine if leadership had been tied to accountability rather than ego and spectacle. Imagine if gratitude had shaped public life. Imagine if the natural world had been treated not as a warehouse of mineral resources to manipulate for profit, but as a living field of relations requiring care, humility. Imagine if balance had mattered more than expansion. What kind of country would this be if its deepest ethic was not ownership, but relationship? Maybe it would be less lonely. I want to say to readers that I'm not interested in turning indigenous life into fantasy or pretending that any people are beyond conflict, contradiction, or failure. But I am interested in the road not taken, because the road that was taken has left us with a nation only 250 years old and already showing the wear of its own unsustainability. We're living inside the consequences of a colonial, violent world view. This is one of the things I keep thinking about. Colonial society does not only produce violence, it produces isolation. It teaches people to stand apart from land, apart from ancestors, apart from community, apart from consequence, and then call that separation freedom. It teaches people to become estranged from the very web of life that makes them possible. That is a spirituality starving way. This is a spiritually starving way to live. Indigenous values across many nations offer something else, not a simple return to some untouched past, but a different orientation, one rooted in relation to the obligations that make us human. Still here, Gary Farmer said, our inherent knowledge of our worldview sustains us still today. And that's true. It sustained us through policies meant to erase us, through forced assimilation, through schools built to break language and memory, through theft of land, children, ceremony, and story, through every paternal structure that insisted it knew better than while leaving destruction in its wake. And still, here we are. There is something profound in that survival, not just endurance for endurance's sake, but continuity. The deep truth is that the values the empire refused did not disappear. The empire did not manage to annihilate our ways of understanding what life is for. Those values survived in our communities, in our languages, in our grandmothers, in our songs, in our resistance, in our humor, in our ceremonies, in the old people who keep speaking even when the world tried to silence them. Maybe the real power of Gary Farmer's words is that they do not leave us only in mourning. They leave us with a challenge, not simply to ask what might have been, but to ask what still could be if Indigenous values of balance, responsibility, and respect for the living world were finally treated as equal, equal in wisdom and in governance, equal in shaping whatever future is left for us. That question is no longer about the past alone. I think about it, whether this society is finally capable of real change, of remembering that a liable future, a livable future, will not be built by the same worldview that has brought us to the edge. And looking at America right now, frayed by cruelty, inhumanity, and amnesia, It is hard not to feel how urgently that change is needed. Thank you, Julie. Boy, it just says everything and so much what I've been thinking. All right, I'm going to close with Jim Page's Palestine. Jim Page.
Story, I make it clear as I can about the faraway troubles in the Holy Land. Pictures that the children etched in your mind, buried in the rubble of the firing line. And Jews and Arabs, the living one and the same, for 1,000 years before the Zionist came. And they came like a river, and they came like a flood, the people calling it the Nakba, cause that's what it was. Oh, Palestine, going home sometime. About the settlers that come from so far away, and talk about the money from the USA. Talk about the bullets and made of plastic and lead, in the shadows of a boot heel over your head. Now what do you do when they come to your home, and they tell you your land is no longer your own? Now do you let them take it, or do you dare to resist, standing in the road with a rock in your fist? Oh, thank you. say we want peace, like it's a moral obligation. But there can be no peace in an occupation. We talk a good talk while we beat on our drums, and after all these years, look at what we have done. Well, does that ever make you think about the friends we endorse? The armies of a general riding on an iron horse. And does that ever make you wonder why it always seems to be such an undemocratic version of democracy? Oh, Palestine, going home sometime. Oh, friend of mine, we will have peace.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.